This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the TriDot Podcast. Today, we will learn all about the effects of elevation on triathlon training and racing. Training in Miami, Florida at 6 feet above sea level is not the same as training in Colorado Springs, Colorado at 6,000 feet above sea level. And today, we'll learn all about this difference and how it affects our body. Our first coach joining us for this conversation is TriDot Master Coach Jeff Raines. Jeff is a certified TriDot coach, a USA Triathlon Level 2, and Ironman U certified coach who has a Master of Science in Exercise Physiology and was a D1 collegiate runner. He has over 60 Ironman event finishes to his credit, including the World Championships in Nice, and he has coached hundreds of athletes to the Ironman finish line. Jeff has been training and coaching with TriDot since 2015. Jeff Raines, what's up, my friend?
Hey, not much, Andrew. You know, let's just say I'm on a high right now, and I'm super elevated and excited for today's topic.
Sure you are. Yep. Also joining us today is the Ultraman himself, TriDot coach Jason Verbrecken. Better known as Coach Verby, Jason lives in San Diego, California, where he works as a Pepsi sales manager, in addition to coaching TriDot athletes and motocross athletes. He has been racing tries for 7 years, racking up 9 Ironman, 1 Ultraman, and 7 extreme triathlon finish lines in that time. And Verby, I've noticed that recently on social media, you've been mountain bike racing lately. How's that going for you?
Well, thank you for having me. It's been going pretty good, except my technical skills are zero. So the very first race, it was the trail two, Verby nothing. I crashed twice. but the second race was much better. I'm having a great time doing it. It's, you know, getting me out of my comfort zone. And just, it's just a whole nother level of just zone 4, zone 5, zone 6 for an hour straight. I'm not used to that.
So I imagine, Verby, that your fitness right now is much greater than your technical skills, right? Like you've got the fitness to compete, but you just got to stop crashing, huh?
Yes. any flats or slight incline going up, I'm passing people, doing awesome. Anything where it gets technical, downhill, rocky, they're flying by me like I'm standing still.
Well, that will have to be a different podcast episode. I know we've already chatted with you on the podcast before about trail running. That was a great conversation with me, you, and TriDot coach Elizabeth James. We'll have to circle back and talk maybe about how things like gravel and mountain biking can play into a triathlete's training regimen, but that's a different podcast for a different day. For today, I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation about elevation, and then wind things down with Vanessa taking over for our coach cool-down tip of the week. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
A funny thing about triathlon, no matter how much equipment and apparel you buy, there is always something else to spend money on in this sport. As our warm-up question today, if you were given $1,000 and had to spend it right now on triathlon gear, what would you go buy? Verby.
Right now, I've been kind of looking at new watches.
Okay.
So I've been checking out the Koros Vertex 2S, which seems like it can do anything in the world. And the battery life is just crazy. Normal everyday life, 40 days, a GPS mode, 118 hours. I mean, it's a watch that I don't need to worry about. And finishing a long, long, multiple day race, my watch, I'm not going to have to worry about charging it. So I'd pick up that. That's around $700. Then I was checking out the new Hoka Skyward X shoes. So they're like everyday Hoka training shoes.
I've seen pictures. Yeah. I've seen pictures of those.
Yeah. Definitely very nice. They have my eye. So they're around 225. So I'd grab those. And then with that last 75, it give me a couple more entries into the mountain bike races.
Sure.
I'm good.
Good man. That's a well-spent $1,000 right there. Jeff Rains, what is this answer for you?
Man, race entry fees are the big one, but I'm actually all signed up for my races this year, so I can't use that one. My kicker's on the fritz. I would get a new smart trainer for my wife and I, but I also need a second one because my wife and I both train, and I switch our bikes on and off of those things 2 or 3 times a week, and so I need two. But the one that we share currently is on the fritz, so that's where I would start. But I'd also get my wife some Garmin Rally power pedals that she could have on her tri bike.
Yeah, and good on you for taking a little bit of your budget and spending some on not just you, but your wife Sarah. Sarah's an amazing athlete who goes and competes yourself. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to spend some of my $1,000 on my wife. I'm going to use it all for myself, kind of like Verby did. But the first thing I would get is some Tri-Rig Scoops Ultimate Aero Bars. We've talked about they have the arm cups that a lot of us use. I've mentioned them on the podcast before. I know a lot of tri-dotters have those Tri-Rig kind of elbow locking aero pads. But they have the full-on bar where like the whole carbon extension is a pad for your arms. There's just more coverage. They're more aero. So those are $750. And so I would just buy those, add them to my Diamond bike, and really just aero out the front of my bike with those Ultimate aero bars. That leaves me a little bit more left over. So I kind of like you, Verby, I've got some new run shoes that have caught my eye. I'm thinking Mizuno just put out a new shoe. It's actually at the time we're recording this podcast, that's coming out in a few weeks, but they're the Mizuno Neo Vista. And all of my run shoes right now are kind of lower stack and a little less cushioning. And this new Mizuno shoe, it's a higher stack, but it's got like a glass plate in there. They look super cool. They're getting a lot of good buzz in the running community. And Mizuno shoes in the Fast have fit my foot really well. They just haven't been as performance oriented. So I would get those new Mizunos, and I think they're going to be a great fit for my foot to do a big mixture of workouts. That brings me to $930. And I'm guessing once tax gets added on, I'm at 1K. So that's the answer for me. Tri-Rig Scoops and my new Mizuno Neo Vista run shoes. We're going to throw this question out to the TriDot audience. The warm-up question now is posted in 3 places. You can answer the warm-up question on Facebook and the I Am TriDot Facebook group. You can answer the warm-up question on Instagram. Our social media team posts this on Tuesdays as an Insta story. And you can now answer the warm-up question in our Circle community. In the TriDot Circle community, there is a full tab for the podcast for you to interact with our episodes and interact with the warm-up question. So go find my post asking you this question. If you had $1,000 and you had to spend it today on Tri Gear, what are you buying? I'm curious.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
TriDot Pool School is the best way for triathletes to learn proper swim form. And it is now the official swim program of Ironman. The TriDot coaching team spent years on the pool deck crafting functional freestyle, and it has already helped hundreds of triathletes improve their swim by an average of 12%. As soon as an athlete registers for TriDot Pool School, they are given a series of dry land exercises to help build crucial muscle memory long before the in-person weekend. The weekend workshop is an engaging blend of instruction, demonstrations, and drills with frequent breaks to rest and reflect. You'll be grouped with swimmers of a similar ability and taught step-by-step how to turn your muscle memory into full-stroke swimming that's smooth and fast. TriDot Pool School is for everyone. We have had entry-level triathletes, back-of-the-packers, mid-packers, some elite age groupers, and even a few pro triathletes in attendance. Ready to jump in? There are pool schools available all over the country and around the world. Head to tridot.com/pool-school and sign up today. All right, today on the podcast, talking all things training high and training low. When the elevation changes, what needs to change in our training. Coach Verby and Coach Jeff are here to educate us all about that. Jeff Verby, well, let's start with this one. I want to hear just a story from the two of you, whether it's sports related or otherwise. This doesn't have to be a sports story, but what was a time that you very specifically remember being highly affected by a certain change in elevation? Coach Verby.
Well, mine is not going to be sport. This one I'll never forget because my wife makes sure I always remember it. My son raced motocross, and every June there's a big race at Mammoth Mountain. The village is probably 8,500 feet above sea level, where they have a week-long motocross races going on. And we got up there. It always starts Father's Day weekend, so my son wasn't racing till the end of the week. So, of course, Saturday, the boys go out and have many adult beverages. And it rolled into then getting up early Sunday morning, which was Father's Day, my day. And we went golfing. And, of course, the beverages continued. Well, they continued a very long time. Past the 19th hole, we were at the 19th hole for many, many hours.
Okay.
And let's just say Monday morning, the worst hangover I have ever felt in my life. I was down for probably till Tuesday evening, just being at that altitude. And that's what I kept telling my wife. It was the altitude's fault. It wasn't the alcohol. This was
naturally.
It wasn't me. It's the altitude. I didn't have too much to drink, but in reality, the combination of both, I will never forget that, and she'll remind me of that many times.
Yeah, as she should. Yeah, as she totally has full right to do so. Jeff Raines, what is the story for you? What was a time you were heavily impacted by a change in elevation?
Oh, gosh. I've been on multiple, like, kind of 4 to 5 day backpacking trips in Colorado, and one of those trips... One of those trips, a group of us, we drove all night. I drove. Everyone else got to sleep. I drove all night. And then we arrived at the trailhead early morning, right? And then, you know, pulling the all-nighter, we hiked all day up to the top to high altitude. And then, man, I started getting horrible headaches, chills, fever. I was in a bad place that first night. The sun was going down. It was getting cold. It was raining and hailing started. I was miserable, miserable. I went to bed early. I drank a whole ton, just went to sleep, got in my sleeping bag. But when I woke up the next morning, I was $1 million. I was fine.
Nice.
And we're going to talk a little bit about that, I think, later as well. So, but yeah, I always remember that horrible first night.
Yep. Now, and so this story for me, my wife and I, for our 1 year anniversary, years and years and years ago, we road tripped from Dallas to Colorado Springs, and we did, you know, Pikes Peak. You know, we did the train up Pikes Peak. We did some hiking. We did the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo in Colorado Springs. We toured the Olympic training facility, Garden of the Gods, all the Colorado Springs stuff to do, we went out and did. But I'll never forget the drive there. I had never, as a kid, like a teenager, anytime I had been at a certain elevation, I never really noticed being affected by it too much. But as an adult, I think 27-year-old, driving from Dallas at like 500 feet elevation to Colorado Springs, 6,000 feet elevation, when you cross the border from New Mexico into Colorado, that there's this kind of like mountain pass you go up and over called the Raton Pass. And I was, it's like a 9-10 o'clock at night. We're driving up the Raton Pass. I'm not a very experienced driver when it comes to the mountains. And just the higher we're getting going up this pass, like the more I'm feeling like foggy and lightheaded, and I'm driving up on a road, zigzagging up this mountain pass. And like, it felt like hairy a little bit. Like I actually, at one point we pulled over and like stopped so I could drink some water and kind of collect myself. But it like, we got up and down okay, and we got to Colorado Springs just fine. But I'll never forget, like, that was the first moment that I remember being like, I am not okay. Like, I feel off. I feel funny. And our first day in Colorado Springs, we hiked around Garden of the Gods, and we were drinking water and felt a little lightheaded. And by day two, I think we felt like $1 million. But to this day, when I drive in the mountains, I get a little skittish, flashbacking back to that moment of like, am I going to be okay? Can I get us to Colorado Springs? I'm not really sure. But So I'm curious, guys, as we kind of transition into our topic off of those stories, what is it that happens in our bodies at a higher elevation that makes us feel the way we described in our stories? And how high do we have to go for these effects to kick in?
You know, at the higher elevations, you know, the pressure decreases, and which lower levels of oxygen. So, of course, you were going to get, like you guys just said, the shortness of breath, the fatigue, the dizziness, you know, difficulty even sleeping sometimes, you know, loss of appetite. All those are effects of being at the higher altitudes. And, you know, it could, and each person's going to vary. Jeff might not feel it right away. And Andrew, you're feeling it at, you know, 5,000 feet, and Jeff could be good to 8,000 feet. So depending on the person, that always varies also. The most noticeable is any time you're 8,200 feet or above is when you can really start having that feeling, getting the altitude sickness. And then obviously, you know, over 11,500, you're going from there. It really, really affects you even more.
Yeah. And I would just throw in kind of like what kind of defines altitude or elevation. There's kind of three different levels or ranges, I guess you could say. Kind of low altitude would be sea level, 0 feet. Up to about 4,900 feet or about 1,500 meters. High altitude is considered kind of anything in a range of 4,900 to 1,150 feet.
Okay.
Or that 1,500 to 3,500 meters. And then very high altitude is kind of that super high, super intensive that Jason was referring to. Very high is considered 11,500 to 18,000 feet, or that 3,500 to 5,500 meters.
Yeah, and I was born in Central Florida, you know, close to ground level. I live my life in Dallas, Texas, pretty close to sea level. So it makes sense that it also takes is a little, just a little dip up, and all of a sudden Andrew is thrown for a whirl. But when we enter into a higher elevation that our body isn't used to, how long does it actually take for our bodies to begin to adjust to that elevation?
You know, that's a good question. Kind of that 4,900 feet or above, you can start to really start, you know, seeing a little bit of some abnormalities. But when ascending too quickly, you know, the body doesn't have enough time to adjust to the changes in air pressure and reduced oxygen. So Jason referred to that partial pressure of oxygen. It's less the higher you go. The oxygen molecules are spread out more. And so we have to breathe more. Our respiratory rate has to increase to get the same amount of oxygen in and utilized as we would at, let's say, sea level. But symptoms usually appear 12 to 24 hours after arriving at high altitude. Usually, again, anything that 4,900 feet or above. And then you start to decrease in severity after about 3 to 4 days at any given altitude. And that's kind of a big piece. A lot of people go up to altitude, but then they may hike a couple thousand feet and then they come back down. They may sleep at this. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But really, we have both short-term and long-term acclimating kind of remedies in our body to adapt to high altitude. So like kind of a short-term in the first 12 to 24 hours at altitude, that's when there's, you know, that lack of oxygen. But there's actually these little like sensors in our carotid arteries in our neck, and they sense that you're at high altitude. And that it senses those lower oxygen levels, and our breathing depth and breathing rate increases to compensate for those lower oxygen levels. This is actually called hyperpneia. And non-essential bodily functions actually are depressed as well. Wow. It's kind of a defense mechanism. And so like one of them, for example, is like food digestion. Like the efficiency of that is kind of put on hold because our body's kind of using that energy to compensate or to kind of cater to that abnormality being at high altitude. Then there's kind of like that, you know, that's the immediate. And then there's like a 0 to 3 days. It takes about 3 to 5 days to actually kind of mostly or you know, a big chunk of the acclimation process. And so 0 to 3 days, physical activity like soon after ascending can cause significant salt and water retention. You might, you know,
wow,
feel or some bloating and it's kind of weird sensations, kind of like you were sensing, you know, in that drive, kind of like I was sensing halfway up that big hike after pulling an all-nighter. But then there's kind of like the long term, like, so you have that 3 to 4 days to a number of weeks. And there's actually a cool formula I'll share in just a second on how long should it take for you to fully acclimate at certain altitudes. But anyways, kind of that more long term, you acclimate the most actually when you sleep. Sleeping at high altitude can help you acclimate to the high altitudes by lowering your blood oxygen levels, which triggers the production of red blood cells and hemoglobin. after several days, maybe a few weeks, you adjust or acclimate to those to that environment. But the hemoglobin levels, which are little proteins in our blood that transport oxygen, when they increase as well, and also like the blood vessel ratios to muscle mass. So all of that compensates and adapts. But when full acclimation is actually determined, when the increase of those red blood cells stops and it reaches a plateau. So that's kind of when you know you're at like equilibrium and you're kind of caught up. But this is a fun equation. I'll end with this. You can multiply your altitude that you're currently at, multiply that in kilometers. So convert the feet or meters down to kilometers, multiply that number by 11.4 days. And that's how long it takes to fully acclimate when in doubt.
Wow.
So let's just say you're at 4,000 meters or 13,000 feet. That's pretty high.
Yeah.
You use that equation, it would take 45.6 days to fully acclimate at that given altitude. Boulder 70.3 is coming up. That's a big one. We have our ambassador camp. Over 100 tri-dotters are racing out there. The elevation of the city of Boulder is 5430, right? 5,430 feet or about 1655 meters. So you take 1.655, you multiply it by that 11.4 days. So it actually would take about 18 days to fully acclimate from sea level up to Boulder altitude.
Wow. So if you're an age grouper and you're flying into town from Texas or Florida or San Diego, where Jason is, and you're planning on racing, I mean, most of us don't have 18 full days to spend in town. So pretty much everybody that travels in for the race that's not from Boulder is a little bit physically compromised without knowing it. Is that fair to say, Jeff?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that is true. You know, 3 to 5 days, when in doubt, for sure, at least give yourself that leading time. If you're not able to arrive, you know, 10, yeah. 11, 18 days ahead of time. But a big portion of your acclimation will occur in that kind of 0 to 3, 0 to 4 days. So I would at least start there.
And I'm curious to see for our tri-dot athletes who are going to Ambassador Camp in Boulder, this year, I'm curious to hear stories of, will anybody struggle on day one in some of those group workouts because they just traveled in from somewhere that isn't at 5,430 feet elevation? We'll see. We'll find out, won't we? I'm curious. This is not a question on our script. I'm totally throwing a curveball to both you guys. So we'll see if you can pull a number out of your butts on this one. But in all of your swimming, biking, running, triathloning, mountain biking, physical activity, whatever it is, trail running, ultra whatever, what is the highest elevation that you have been at physically exerting yourselves like in race mode effort kind of thing? For me, I'll just start. I've done most of my racing in Texas and Florida and California and New Zealand and Greece near the beach. I haven't done any significant like physical effort at an elevation, outside of just going for a run, visiting Denver or something. I've done some hiking where I've climbed Clingman's Dome in Tennessee, Mount Mitchell, the high point of North Carolina, but nothing where I'm like triathloning in race mode at an elevation. Jeff, what's this answer for you?
Oh gosh, I've been all over the U.S., Mount Mitchell, North Carolina, Mount Lemmon in Tucson, race Nice, France. So that's obviously a big one. I've done a lot of 12 and 14,000 foot hikes. I'd say, you know, 12 to 14 is at a high intensity effort or working hard is kind of my peak.
Jason, do you kick both of our butts on this one as Mr. Ultraman?
No, I'm same with kind of Jeff. Okay. A lot of my X-Tri stuff are up in the mountains. I know when I went to Nepal and raced the Himalayan X-Tri.
So cool.
We ran... You know, we had to basically run up a mountain, then come back down, and that was the 4,000 meters we ran up to, which is 13,123 feet. So that's kind of my top in there. And I mean, I definitely could see the athletes that were majorly affected by it. I mean, I was running with a guy, and he ended up said he crawled to the turnaround point just because he just had no energy. I said, you know, another guy with their trekking poles, they were leaned over the trekking poles, just trying to get that oxygen. And yeah, it definitely big effects even more when you're pushing that effort while you're racing.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to know why I keep asking Verby on the podcast, it's one, he's a good coach. He knows a lot of stuff, but two, he's also the coolest guy I know. How many triathletes do you know who have raced in Nepal? Not many. I know one. It's Jason Verbrecken, and that's why he's on the podcast as often as he is. But so getting back to the training implications of elevation, what does anything need to change in our training regimen when we are maybe traveling or we've gone to something like Boulder Ambassador Camp, where all of a sudden we're at a higher elevation, it's new, we haven't adapted to it. You know, what do we need to change in our training sessions to make sure we're doing our workouts correctly and not overextending ourselves in a new elevation?
You know, as far as athletic performance kind of in general at altitude, you can kind of define that as like explosive events, more anaerobic, and then like an endurance athlete at high altitude. But this is kind of neat, actually, like explosive events, more anaerobic activities, like let's say long jump, sprints and track, maybe up to 400 meter races. They're actually kind of enhanced at high altitude and you know, kind of provides like better outcomes because there's that reduction in atmospheric pressure. So there's less oxygen, there's thinner air, right? And so there's less resistance in the air, hence faster times and longer jumps. For example, baseball players, right, can at a given effort at sea level hitting the ball, that same effort, the ball will travel further. So actually, this is cool. Side note, the Olympic Committee approved performances over 1K meters, so 3,280 feet, that performances, world records will count, but they will put like an A next to it, that achievement, right, indicating that it was at altitude. It's kind of cool, kind of neat.
And it feels like counterintuitive from what I would think. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really neat. But like in endurance performance, let's say like aerobic capacity is definitely reduced at high altitude, and like a safe range is kind of like a 12-16%.
Wow.
And so if you're not acclimating or you're not racing, you know, you're not there for weeks ahead of time, and you're only there that kind of 0 to 3, 0 to 5 days before a race, aerobic capacity can be reduced by about 12-16%. Endurance athletes also can benefit from you can benefit from high altitude and it's called like the live high and train low. So if you live at high altitude, you can do lower intensities up there, but you're supposed to kind of go down closer to sea level to do your super high volumes and your super high intensities. You can't do quite as much super high intensity for longer durations at high altitude. So the adaptations that help cope without altitude can reduce performance back at sea level. And so like in the athletes' bodies, you become acclimatized to high altitude, and you're able to carry more oxygen in the blood per beat of the heart. But then when they compete at lower altitudes, they get kind of a natural boost in performance. Now, if you're training at high altitude or you live there and you train low, let's say, and then you go and race an endurance event and you're pushing hard, you have some anaerobic efforts inside of there, you might only see, it's usually about a 1-2% improvement, right? Okay. So the average age grouper going and training in Colorado for a month or two and then doing this big, maybe let's say a half Ironman down closer to sea level, you know, you're not just going to see, you know, an hour knocked off of your time. But there are benefits of,
I mean, that's good to know, right? It's good to know that, like, you see, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but you see professional athletes kind of going out of their way to train at certain elevations in certain parts of their season. And we'll talk about why they do that in a little bit, but to know that for us and for the amount of time we could actually do that for, that's the potential gain, right? We're not talking about you're gonna become a 1 hour faster Ironman athlete. Like that's just part of chasing those marginal gains, where maybe if you're trying to get that Kona slot or qualify for Boston, or if you're trying to place on the podium at a big event coming up, maybe it's worth considering. But if you're just Andrew, the average triathlete, just trying to go under, you know, sub 12 or sub 6 or whatever your goal is, maybe it's not worth going out of your way for that 1 or 2%. That's really interesting, Jeff.
Yeah, and that live high, train low, right? You can't do quite as much high intensity at altitude. That's called detraining. But rest and sleep at high altitude, you know, that's big. And long story short, sorry, I'll end here, really, is you have to ease into training your first 3 to 4 days. then you slightly increase back into intensity and a little bit of volume, but lighter intensities should be completed at high altitude, and higher intensities and racing should be completed at lower altitudes.
Now,
in an ideal world.
Verbi, I know that you have done a lot of training, kind of getting ready for events with wild elevation swings, some high elevation stuff in your Xterras and your ultras, and your extreme triathlons. Do you have anything to add here when you're working with your athletes? Is there anything they need to consider if they're training somewhere that's a higher elevation than what they're already used to?
Yeah, just, you know, what Jeff said, it can be a very valuable tool, especially, you know, if you're looking for that 1%, 2%, and going up to do a camp is very beneficial for the guys. And, you know, like Jeff was saying, you know, you just have to carefully plan it, monitor your training, because that being at altitude, and if you do a higher intensity workout, that stress on your body is going to be, you know, more than the stress down at sea level. So you got to really be watching it. You know, you want to be there to get the best benefits and not overstress your body and have the negative effect on you. And I know even some of my professional motocross athletes, they have come, you know, Denver's one of the places they go. And a lot of them, how we talked earlier, you know, those effects don't take place to 12 to 24 hours. Well, they're lucky enough, they can fly in Saturday morning. They practice and race on the same day, and they're flying out Saturday night. So they're just trying to completely avoid that, where, you know, other ones come up a day or two early, they're getting the altitude sickness. And, you know, if you have that option, if you are going to race at that high altitude, you got that option to get there, get it done, and get out of there. You know, you can, you know, play those odds of not getting sick. And
yeah,
you know,
that's interesting.
Performing the best you can still.
Yeah. So for our listeners who do use Tridot for their training, and obviously we have a lot of Tridot athletes in our audience. We have some athletes who like the podcast that don't use Tridot for their training. We're welcome to have you. Glad you're here. This question just doesn't apply to you. For Tridot athletes, EnviroNorm will actually adjust your training paces for you when it knows you are at a higher elevation. So it's crucial when you are traveling, let Tridot know where you're doing your workout. Let it know I'm not at home. Punch in where you actually are and what time of day you're doing that workout. Jeff Raines, talk us through how this feature of Tridot works and what we should expect to see in our paces when we're at elevation.
Enorm is amazing. If you're not accounting for environmental conditions, then, you know, there's a lot of training stress out there that is being unaccounted for. But our Enorm is amazing. It takes into account, the elevation of the city above sea level that you're in, the temperature, the humidity, all sorts of factors. It's really cool. I'll just say, kind of a cool story. I used to live in Austin, Texas, really close to sea level, 489 feet. I moved to West Texas, Midland, Texas. It's 3,000 feet above sea level. So again, it's not high altitude. It's not above 4,900 feet. But there
I didn't
is a
know the
big
state
difference.
Of Texas had 3,000 feet above sea level, to be honest.
I actually just hiked Guadalupe Peak. It's the highest natural point in the state of
cool.
Texas. 8,700 feet.
Wow.
But anyways, so I actually, the month before I moved, I did an FTP test. And then the month after I moved to 3,000 feet higher elevation, I actually did worse by 4 watts. And I was like, what? It's been a month or two. I've been training well. Like, why did I disprove? Well, then I go into the Enorm of my assessment, and I actually had a 7-watt improvement on my functional threshold, even though I achieved 4 watts less on my test, because Tridot, Rundot, and then our RaceX kind of knows the conditions at which you're doing your assessments and your daily training and your racing. And it adjusts your power and pace zones as the weather changes in your city all day long. So it's really, really cool. Your power and pace zones change all day long. But what if I'm in Texas at 3,000 feet, and I did a work trip in 12,000 feet in Colorado?
Yeah.
There's an intensities tab in the app, and it knows the IP address where you're at, and it'll take all of your paces from your hometown and all that, convert it, apply it to where you're currently at, and your zones will reflect that so you don't overtrain or undertrain when you're traveling. Pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, very cool stuff. And Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you moved from Austin to Midland, and you had that experience where all of a sudden you're living your life at a higher elevation. Isn't it true of TriDot, and correct me if this is wrong, that it has built into the algorithm that, okay, that this person moved there and he's now been there 1 week, he's been there 2 weeks, he's been there 3 weeks, he's been there 2 months. Doesn't it begin to kind of correct back to your baseline that, okay, he's been at this elevation for this long, and it basically takes you back to normal over time? Is that correct?
It does. Yes, it does to an aspect. And still being at 3,000 feet, even if you're acclimated and have lived there relatively long term, there are still hindrances, even though you acclimate. But yes, it does take into account a lot of that, and then how long you're there over time.
So I alluded to this a minute ago, but I see on social media all the time, you know, that a lot of running pros, cycling pros, triathlon pro athletes, that they'll use elevation camps. Well, they'll intentionally go out of their way to live at a higher elevation from where they normally live, in order to train for a specific part of their season to make some sort of certain adaptation. How are pros doing this? Why are pros doing this? What's kind of the best practices for making this actually work for you in your training? Coach Verby, talk to us about how pros use elevation camps to improve their fitness.
Yeah, it's going to vary, obviously, depending on that pro athlete's goals. You know, are they do they have an upcoming race that is at altitude? Or are they just trying to get that, you know, as Jeff was saying, that extra red blood cells in your body, so when they race down at a lower level, they're getting more oxygen carried to their muscles. So, you know, and that, you know, the duration of the camp is going to, you know, vary. Most of the time it's several weeks to months before that, you know, that race, their A race, what they're planning for, because they're still going to want to get in their gains and then get in a good taper. So they're, you know, they're planning it out, figuring out when's the best, when they're going to peak, when they're going to get down back to regular altitude, or, you know, head to the race in altitude somewhere. You know, and then again, the altitude levels for them are going to vary between 5,000 and 10,000 feet. And if, you know, making sure there's training facilities, if you're a triathlete, where am I going to swim? Does it have a pool? you know, those are all definitely things they look at for their camp, and at what altitude are those facilities at? And, you know, they're trying to balance all that and also getting in good training while not getting altitude sickness or, you know, having those effects that are going to deteriorate their training. So, I mean, they're using it to get that 1%, 2%, whatever they can get out of it, but they're being strategic about it, figuring out, all right, how long are we going to go? How long before our race? What altitude? What do we have available? You know, can we do it? Is there still snow on the ground? You forget, most of these places at altitude have, you know, winter climates, you know, so it's definitely a lot of moving parts, but when done right, it's huge for that race at altitude, or again, just having those extra red blood cells in your body to race at that higher level.
Yeah. And it's funny. You talk about just what that location needs to have, like what are the certain conditions that have to come together for that training elevation camp to do what it needs to do. And I think because of that, that's probably why, if you do pay attention on social media, you'll see it's the same handful of cities that it seems like everybody goes to. Right. And it's because those cities meet all those requirements and have the weather, have the elevation, have the facilities. And there's one or two that come to mind that I see a lot of the European athletes go to. There's one or two that come to mind that I think a lot of the American and North American athletes go to. So very interesting stuff. Jeff Raines, do you know anything kind of additional about how and why athletes are using this at the pro level?
Yeah, you know, I'll just add that you have to acclimate to sea level as well. Okay. And that's something that we kind of forget about a little bit.
Interesting, but yeah.
And another kind of aspect is, you know, you have a great week of training. Maybe it's even at sea level. It takes a week or two, 10 to 14 days or whatever. There's a residual on the back end of absorbing that fitness, recovering from it, and kind of giving you that improvement on the back end. So if it takes arguably a week or two to really see the fitness gained from a training block or whatever, But then you go to altitude and you spend 1 to 3 weeks there, let's say, like a pro level training camp, right? And so, you know, being up there for that long of a time, you get, right, the altitude benefits, okay? But then usually they're strategically placed where, am I going to train for a week up there or 3 weeks up there? But then when I get home, how long is it going to take me to fully acclimate back to sea level? But then when is my race?
Wow.
And so these camps are strategically placed usually 2 to 5, 2 to 6 weeks out, 3 to 5 weeks out from a big A race. So they're going up there, they're training for 1 to 3 weeks, but then they're giving themselves 1 to 3 weeks or so, right, to come home, absorb that training, start to acclimate back to sea level, but they're able to push a lot harder down at sea level when they get back. And so there's a big timing and it depends. But sure. I'll kind of just say this, that you don't have to go travel and live somewhere for a month. You know, there's other modalities. Remember I said earlier, like you train at high altitude you live at high altitude or sleep at high altitude, but you train low, like you drive down the mountain and do your high intensity sessions down there. Well, you can mirror that or mimic that at home. There's elevation training masks that you can just wear at sea level, so your body thinks you're at altitude. The hypoxia sleep chambers, I know Jason can definitely chat about those. And then there's you know, there's just different ways that they actually have these like altitude rooms now where you can kind of rent, go in, do a workout in there and get kind of that chamber experience. So there's just lots of different ways to get that adaptation.
Yeah. And Jeff, I'm glad you very naturally brought up kind of the other side of the coin that there are, just like there's benefits and reasons to train at high elevations and considerations to be made at a higher elevation. There's also a different effect on your body if you're at sea level. And I think I forget that that's part of the equation, again, because I've always lived close to sea level. And so my body knows what sea level feels like, whereas other people, it's not necessarily the case. But, you know, I didn't know that was part of the equation for a professional using a high altitude camp, I just thought, okay, you come down from the mountains and you do your race while your body's used to you're absorbing that sweet oxygen at sea level. I forgot that there is the part of the equation where you have to spend some time back at sea level before you're really primed and ready to go again. So I'm glad you brought that up. And one of the things you mentioned is that athletes can use those hypoxia sleep chambers to kind of manipulate that and simulate that. And Coach Verby, you actually sell a chamber device like that helps athletes simulate being closer to sea level and can manipulate oxygen levels for an athlete. You know, so what are the benefits to being at sea level and getting your body as much oxygen as possible?
Yeah, I actually, hyperbaric chamber. So which actually, I got one right here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
right in time for us to take the podcast on video. Jason's got the AeroFit chamber right behind him for us to see it. Love it. Perfect timing.
Yeah. Yeah. So what that does is actually, you know, Jeff talked about it earlier, when you go up in altitude, you decrease the pressure. Well, what the chamber does back there, it increases the pressure. I'm going to kind of geek us out for a second.
Yep, do it. Go there.
So I read Henry's Law. It states that the consistent temperature, the amount of gas dissolved in the liquid, is directly proportional to the partial pressure of that gas above the liquid.
Sure it is.
Yes. So basically saying once you're, you know, what that does is fill up with 93% oxygen, 93 to 100% oxygen. And then it's pressurizing. And each chamber varies by how much pressure is increasing. Well, that pressure changes that gas into a liquid, which then, you know, helps absorb into all your tissues and cells. So not only are you breathing we breathe 33% oxygen right now is what's around us in the air. So in that chamber, you're getting 93 to 100% oxygen. Wow. So you're getting more oxygen in the system. Then that pressure is compressing it and turning it into a liquid, thanks to Henry. You know, that's his law. He made
good
the rules.
So
that's what it's doing. And it's getting all over that body where you usually couldn't get it. It's absorbing into the cells, into the tissues, helping you heal faster, you know, it's mainly used a lot with recovery, healing, wounds, all that helps speed up the process because you're getting that extra oxygen to the places where your body doesn't usually get it, or you're getting it in more of abundance at a time.
Yeah. And obviously, if anybody listening, you know, we talk about at the start of the episode in our warm-up question, if you had $1,000, what would you throw it towards? If you've got all the recovery toys and you like the idea of having a
hyperbaric chamber.
Hyperbaric chamber. If you like the idea of owning one, definitely get in touch with Coach Verby, and he'll be happy to educate you and see what can happen there and if it's a good fit for you. But Jason, how, you know, you on just on Instagram, right? I see you in it pretty frequently because you have one yourself. Like, how are you leveraging that in your? Is it a daily thing? Is it every so often? Is it an after hard sessions? Like, where does that fit into a recovery routine?
For me, you know, since I've been doing it now for multiple years, I'm kind of, you know, I'll kind of cycle it. I'll, you know, I'm mainly 2 to 3 times a week. I try to, depending on my schedule. And I'll do it either the night before a big session or even get up, you know, on the weekend, I'll get up early and get at it before the session and just, have that extra oxygen in my body. It may be placebo effect on that part, but you know, but I'll definitely try after long hard sessions to get in there that evening. And then I'll actually stop it for a couple of weeks too. And then I'll get back in it and I'll go 4 days straight, then a day or two off, 2 days straight, and then just kind of a day here, a day there, just kind of cycling it.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I've got two questions left, and then we'll transition into our cool down, where I'll let Vanessa take over the show for the coach cool down tip of the week. I'm curious, though, when we are training or racing at a higher elevation, we haven't talked about fueling and hydration yet. Does anything need to change in our fueling and hydrating needs when we're at a different elevation? Coach Verby, what do you know?
Oh, definitely. Okay. You know, our body's working harder. We're, as Jess said, we're increasing our respiratory rate. We're sweating more. So what's going to happen? Our body is trying to keep our body cooler. We're using more calories, and most of the time it's the carbs helping us cool down. So we're not, you know, and again, loss of appetite. If you're not, you know, you get up there, you're not eating much, and now all of a sudden your body's working harder all around. We need those extra carbs. We need that extra hydration, the electrolytes, it's huge on you up there. You got to really, you know, having your nutrition and carbs dialed in wherever you live, and then making sure you're upping that when you come up to altitude is going to play effect on how good you are training.
Yeah, I definitely remember, you know, going back to my earlier answer, talking about my wife and I's trip to Colorado Springs, where we drove there, and I just remember reading, like, you know, especially like as lightheaded as we were on that drive, I remember reading like, oh, when you're at elevation for the first time, like stay hydrated. And so we were just like down in water bottles, like nobody's business, and like peeing like the whole trip, you know, just because like we were just like freaked out that like, oh man, like the one thing it says to do is not to drink alcohol and to stay hydrated. And so we listened to that the way we responded on that drive. But Coach Jeff Raines, anything else to add here about fueling and hydrating at elevation?
Yeah, there's a couple little kind of quote rules on how much to drink. Like, great, I know I need more water, I need more electrolytes, but how much? How do I do it? What do I do? Couple quick things, you know, like Jason said, your body loses more body water through that increased respiration and urination actually as well. You kind of mentioned that, Andrew.
Yeah.
But until you're fully acclimated, you should increase your daily fluid intake by about 1 to 1.5 liters per day. So you kind of know what you have at a normal day at home to kind of maintain equilibrium, metabolic functioning, and all that. So 1 to 1.5 liters per day, right, until you're fully acclimated is how you should increase your fluids. But it shouldn't just be straight water. Too much straight water can actually bloat you. And so the same ratio, that delta of the increase of the fluid intake, should include the same kind of ratio of the like electrolyte replacement as well. And Our bodies also use carbohydrates as the main and preferred energy source at high altitude. So when racing, you might up your carb intake per hour by about 10% or so. out there on race day. But I'd say at high altitude, you want to avoid eating things that disrupt digestion.
Okay.
Because remember, your digestion at first is kind of put on hold, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, like high fatty foods, alcohol, especially food high in excess salt and sugar, and even too much caffeine. So you're going to want to kind of take note of those, at least those first 3 to 5 days. Can just be cognizant of what you're eating and what that main kind of macro is in that meal.
So I imagine there are athletes out there who are listening to this episode who have races coming up where the elevation of the race is much higher than where they live and train. Boulder 70.3 that we talked about earlier is a prime example of this for anybody listening to this episode who's racing Boulder. Or maybe there's an athlete that has a race coming up where there will be wild changes in elevation throughout the race. A lot of those ultra trail races, you know, you start at one elevation and you go up and down and up and down and up and down throughout the course of the race. How can we prepare for these kinds of circumstances based on whatever elevation we currently live at? And Jeff, we'll let you respond to this, and Coach Ferber, you can shut down our main set today after that.
Cool. Yeah, I'll throw out something kind of unique. First of all, is there's kind of the 1K rule. It's 1,000 feet to about like 1,600, but you're supposed to sleep only about 1K higher each night at high altitude than the night before. Okay, so anything above about 8,000 feet. So let's say you hike up to 8,000 feet, you sleep there your first night. You can hike up to 12,000, 14,000 feet the next day. But before you go to bed that first night, you're supposed to sleep at about 9K, right? If 8K was the night before. Kind of think of it as like climbing Mount Everest. We've all heard of that, you know, the base camp, right?
Camp
they'll hike
one,
up.
Camp
and
two, camp three,
exactly.
Camp four. Yeah.
That's what they're doing. They're acclimating from low to high to super high altitude. And it's that sleep high, you know, train low. But you don't want to climb too high and then sleep there that night. So that 1K rule is kind of neat. But anyways, as the race fluctuates, so maybe you sleep at 5K, but your race goes up to 8K, 10K, and all of that. It's okay to do that in a day in a race. You're just going to want to take note of your respiratory rate. A lot of times people think their heart rate is actually a lot higher than it is. They might be hyperventilating a little bit, but sometimes your heart rate might be riding a lot lower than what you actually think it is. So that perception and that rate of perceived exertion, you're just going to want to watch the heart rate and kind of how it responds that first day or two. And then you're going to want to adjust mid-race on, okay, I feel like I'm in zone four, but you look down, your respiratory rate's a little high, but your heart rate might be, you know, one zone lower than you think. And so maybe you can push a little harder. So you're going to have to just play that game a little bit as the race goes on.
Yeah. And speaking to that rule, you know, that, you know, if you are an athlete and you're flying in to Boulder for Boulder 70.3 and, you know, you have 3 nights in a hotel before the race, you know, so obviously at that point you can't necessarily adopt the 1K rule like you could in a different circumstance, but you can adopt what Jeff was just talking about there with just having that knowledge of on race day, you know, keep an extra eye on your heart rate. And be a little bit more mindful of how you're breathing at whatever, you know, RPE you're currently at, because that there might be a disconnect between the two of what you're used to. Really good tangible takeaway there for all of our athletes. Coach Ferber, what do you have to add here about elevation changes for race day?
Yeah, and I mean, your biggest thing is if you're going to be doing this stuff at home, like Jeff mentioned many things, and the altitude, I personally have an altitude tent also, of course. And, you know, like the big thing, you know, don't just think because you have an altitude tent, oh, I can jump up to 8,000 feet because I'm only sleeping in it. I love the whole theory, sleep high, train low.
Yeah.
And obviously you have to do that if you're at home using a tent, but don't be like, well, I'm spending most of my day at sea level. Well, I'm going to start out at 10,000 feet the first night sleeping. You know, for me personally, I start at like 5,000 feet and I go up every night by 500. I don't even, wow. I'm even more cautious than Jeff's rule because the sleep's interrupted. I'm waking up very dehydrated. All the symptoms we talk about happens because I'm spending 8 hours in that tent during the night. And, you know, you're tossing and turning. You're not used to it. The sleep isn't good for a while. It takes me a few weeks before I'm sleeping in there good. So I'll slowly increase. And a lot of times I'll even stay at an altitude for a certain time just because I'm not getting a good night's sleep. So I want to stay there before I'm, you know, stress my body more by adding more feet of elevation that I'm sleeping at. You know, again, the training masks are a good thing. There's, you know, even breathing techniques. I'm not telling everybody to go try and do this.
Sure.
But there's breathing techniques where, like, example, swimming. Instead of you take a breath every stroke. Well, now try to go every two strokes. And then bump it to every three strokes, every four. That little bit more is making your body put the stress on your system like you're at altitude. It's giving you that hypoxic feeling and you know, keeping the more carbon dioxide in your body. So, and then even you could be out for a walk, a zone two run, and you see a light pole. Well, hold your breath. And I'm telling you, be cautious with it.
Yeah,
you know,
don't get yourself in trouble. Don't be driving down the road.
Disclaimer.
Doing this.
Yes. Disclaimer. Don't be doing the driving. You know, don't see. Well, I'm going to set a record and hold my breath for 3 minutes, and you know, you're passed out on the side of the road. But these are all ways to put your body into that feeling of getting hypoxic. One good thing too is getting an oxygen sensor to see where your body's at, especially if you're going to have an altitude tent. Using the training mask, you can measure how much oxygen's in your body. And, you know, you definitely don't want to see it below 80. You know, most of the time you put it in, you're 95%, you're maybe 98. You know, getting that sensor is another key tool to help you tracking everything. As Coach Jeff was saying, watch your heart rate, monitor, write it down, you know, see where you're sitting at. You know, definitely use all that stuff to your advantage, taking good notes and seeing how your body is responding to it.
Yeah. And don't go to the 19th hole bar, like Coach Furby, and have a lot of adult beverages the night before your race.
No, do not do that.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Hello there, everyone. I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm, and I am pumped to bring you the Coach Cooldown tip. With me today is Julie McPhillamy. She began coaching with TriDot in 2022, and she is excited to help people reach their goals and cross those finish lines. Julie is a well-seasoned athlete herself. She has run countless half marathons, 12 marathons. She is a 3x 70.3 finisher and a 2x full distance finisher. And she is no stranger to the TriDot platform, as she has been using it since 2016. On the coaching side of things, Julie specializes in coaching athletes who are new to the sport, those ready to cross their first short course finish line, and intermediate long course athletes as well. She has a soft spot for the 40-plus female crowd because this is when she actually started doing triathlon herself. Julie's line of work as a flight attendant comes along with a very non-traditional schedule, and part of her knowledge base is working with athletes who have complicated work hours but still want to fit all the training in. A fun fact about Julie is that she used to be a tennis player and finally got to attend Wimbledon in 22, which has been on her bucket list forever. Welcome to the show, Julie, and tell us about your adventure at Wimbledon.
Thanks, Vanessa. I got to go to Wimbledon. It was the best experience. I had a layover in London, and I was working with one of my best friends, and we decided to both go, and then a couple of the people on the crew were like, hey, can we come too? So there was a big group of us, and we got to sit on the lawn. We brought food and drinks and just hung out all day. And it was the beginning of it. So it was like still all the seeds were there and all the matches were going on. So we walked around and got to see a ton of different people play. And it just was a perfect day. No rain, no, you know, nothing that happens in London usually. And I was just so excited to see them play on a grass court, which I have never seen before. It's, you know, pretty rare here in the States to see. So all in all, it was just such a cool experience. I'm so thankful that my job allowed me to do it.
I'm so happy that you got to do something that you've been wanting to do since probably you were, you know, small small kid. So
yeah, really very young. I was very young and I used to like it. Yep.
That's great. I'm really excited to hear what tip you have for us today.
My tip today is don't sweat the schedule. I am no stranger to having a different and unconventional schedule. And that was one of the reasons I went with TriDot in the first place, was the flexibility of being able to move things around. Back in my marathon days, my first one, I took the schedule and I followed it to a T. And that was simply for fear of failure. I mean, if it told me to do a certain run on a certain day, there was no way I was skipping it, or I would never move it to a different day. And TriDot itself gives the flexibility to move things around. There's plenty of things that you have to do, like prioritize your sleep, your nutrition, all those different things. And if you have a non-traditional schedule like myself, some of those have to be put on the forefront before the actual workout itself. So you might have to take a nap. You may have to eat something before and plan all those little things out. One other thing that is kind of good to, if you have a coach with TriDot, they can go into your schedule and they can dial it back. So if you have a specific workout for the day, you can go in, they can go in and say it was supposed to be at a level 8. So there's levels 1 through 10 and it was at a level 8. You can say, hey, I'm pretty tired today, or I've had XYZ things going on. They can dial it back and it'll just dial back the intensity of that workout, and you'll still get some benefits from it, but it won't put you to be too tired or overwork you or potentially injure you. That's a great thing that the coach side or the mentor side of TriDot allows. So, you know, don't sweating that schedule. You can make these things fit in and adjust to what you have going on in your life. There's a lot of flexibility.
I think that most triathletes need to hear this message over and over again. I know that I certainly do, because we oftentimes feel that the only way forward is to do exactly what's prescribed to us. And I know that for myself, I've really benefited from the coaching aspect of TriDot and having someone be able to say to me, you know, you've had a tough week, or you're working through a niggle, let's just dial back your training session for that day. And prior to having a coach, I would have gone and done that workout as it was laid out, just because I wanted to make sure that I was doing everything exactly as it was prescribed. Because like yourself, I was afraid of failing and not reaching all of the goals that I wanted, when in reality, it would have been better for me to take a rest day. And so I think that what you're saying in not sweating the schedule is, it's okay to listen to your body and to, you know, miss a session or to move a session around. Because we all have lives to live, you know, like we have things to do, and we have family opportunities and engagements that we want to participate in. And that's what's most important. So I really appreciate you sharing this tip with us today about the schedule and being flexible. I think that is really, really valuable.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And just remember, TriDot will adjust to you. So if you move that schedule and it's a little too close to another one, it will adjust again. You know, your long bike or run on the weekend may be adjusted because you did something too close to it. It almost knows you better than you know yourself. And that's really helpful in the long run.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.